From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. The Georgia legislature gets only 40 days to make state law.
We ought to be controlling our own destiny as a state to be able to provide access to cannabis oil for our citizens, not waiting on another state near us or far from us to come up with a solution, or the federal government, which clearly has not been able to come up with a solution. We ought to be able to do it ourselves. We ought to be smart enough to do that.
That's Republican Alan Peek. He sponsored a medical marijuana bill that might become law soon. But first, Monday author Hannah Palmer lives near Hartsfield-Jackson Airport. She says the airport's success has not carried over to the neighborhoods in the airport's flight path.
The closest amenities to my house are actually behind a wall, a security wall. I think it's worth considering, if we have this big hunk of public infrastructure, how can we make it more of a public amenity that the surrounding community can enjoy?
Here are your first thoughts. Vince Aragon says he grew up in Forest Park in the 90s.
When I go back now, the difference is night and day, and I think a large part of that has to do with the airport and also the gentrification that's occurring inside the perimeter.
We love to get your stories like this and your thoughts. You can call us at 404-500-9457 like Vince did. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or post on Facebook and we might feature your comments on the show. It's On Second Thought. Happy Sine Die.
Under the joint resolution, this House stands adjourned sine die.
I am a German and a rabbi. I declare this House adjourned sine die.
Sine die is what we call the end of the legislative session at the Georgia State Capitol. Lisa Ray Am joins us now. She covers the Capitol for GBB TV's Lawmakers. Good morning.
Sine die. It is day 40.
Good morning. Syllables in this, Lisa? Because I sometimes hear extra syllables like sine die.
Sine die. But, you know, we just heard from the audio there. That was a long die there. And you know, a lot of lawmakers today saying virtually hallelujah, you know, no more days. Technically it means without day, meaning we're not coming back for any more. The legislative session is officially over, and all the papers get tossed in the air, and tradition has it that it used to be the handkerchief, but it's quite a scene, quite an event, and you certainly understand why, because it has certainly been a long 40 days for those legislators under the Gold Dome.
Now, sine die is how people in Georgia pronounce it. It comes from Latin, and if you were to pronounce it according to Latin guidance, it would be sine die.
Sine die. Doesn't sound so convincing, does it?
Not as celebratory.
Right, yes.
All right, so let's go over what has survived so far and maybe has the chance to survive sine die and get to the governor's desk.
Well, there's a lot of things, as you very well know. Campus rape, we were chatting
about earlier today. Campus rape, we had thought, had gone away.
Yeah, and you know, that's the tricky thing, Celeste. This last week, there's been a lot of stripping and changing of bills, and that's what happened here with SB 71. It had something to do with something completely different, and now it was revived from an earlier bill. The language is still the same. Its intent is to protect those who are accused of campus rape, to give them due process. A lot of rape victims don't like this, but it keeps coming up, came up again at the last minute on Tuesday night, and we'll be up for vote again today.
Okay. And are you going to make predictions as the chances for that this campus rape bill will?
You know, its author, Representative Earl Earhart, has been very, very vocal, very, very adamant. Seems that it's gaining steam. But again, I think legislators are taking heed to the voices of rape victims.
Right.
One in particular, a proponent, her name is Grace Starling, who's been down at the Gold Dome every day, just saying how cruel this bill is to victims who are, you know, forced to report these crimes when necessary.
It's opposed by every single university, every single university police department. We do want to hear that. Here is Earl Earhart, which you, as you said, sponsored this bill.
It's very obvious that campuses need to be in the business of education, not in the business of the civil authorities and punishing those who break the law with respect to sexual assault. There's not enough money, time, training, or effort that can be spent on our university campuses to make those campuses safe or to bring to justice those who commit these significantly vile acts on campus.
Have we had any indication from the governor that if this actually passes, he might sign it?
Well, we don't know. It's going to the Senate. You know, the House revived it again, stripped SB 71. It was a health savings accounts bill. And now, you know, revived this campus rape bill. It goes to the Senate. So we're going to have to get a feel from them at this point. But like you said, you know, it was gone. Now it's back. You just never know. So
that's
one thing about signing day. You just don't know. Signee Dye, rather, you just don't know what will happen.
And Robbie Medhead tweets that. He says, when it comes down to it, the first 36 days of the legislative session don't really matter. All bets are off now. And I wonder if that's true for something which has returned from last year, and that is the campus carry bill, since we're talking about universities. Here's a little bit of Georgia Governor Nathan Deal. He vetoed a very similar bill last year.
These sanctuaries of learning, which are college campuses, are supposed to be safe because other people are providing that security.
So even if this should survive, there's a very real question. You're already looking skeptical.
I know that he will sign it. But, you know, here's the thing. This is Mandy Ballinger's baby. And last year, Governor Deal indicated that he wanted the change regarding child care centers on college campuses. He just, you know, found that to be a no-no.
To keep guns out of child care
centers. Yeah, to keep
guns
out of there. Well, they've changed the language to reflect that. So you would think, okay, maybe, you know, the governor's pleased with that. But rumor has it that he still may not sign off on this campus carry bill. I understand that there's some possibly some negotiations going on behind the scene to kind of tweak it so that he will sign it. But again, we just don't know.
And again, talking about opposition, there is widespread opposition to this bill allowing guns on university campuses.
And understandably so. A lot of opponents, what is the purpose? It opens the door in their eyes to so many other things. A student who may not be all there mentally and who may, you know, be easily provoked.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, what does that open the door to? So there are a lot of questions, a lot of concerns, and a lot of lawmakers that I've talked to just don't want it.
But let's hear again from Mindy Ballinger. She sponsored the campus carry bill. She's speaking here with reporters just after it passed the House.
In working as a victim advocate, it's really the God-given right that people have to not be a victim. States that have enacted campus carry or campus safety have become safer. The numbers prove that, and so we just want to afford that protection to all Georgians.
I should mention, she says numbers prove that. We've actually not been able to find any of these numbers that she say that prove that. When they checked numbers in a couple other states, like Colorado, that did have campus carry, that hasn't been borne out. So she hasn't produced that. I just want to be clear on that. If you're just joining us right now, we're speaking with Lisa Ram. She covers the state capitol for GPB's TV show, Lawmakers. Okay, so Lynn, let's talk about another one, which everyone thought was going to be all we were talking about, right? And that would be casino gambling. That bill was sponsored by Senator Brandon Beach. Here he is on Lawmakers earlier.
We compete with New Orleans, Nashville, Orlando, and Las Vegas, and they have what those four have in common is entertainment and nightlife, and we get complaints that we don't have nightlife here in the Atlanta market.
So what has happened with the gambling bill?
Gone for now, but you never know. It may be attached to something later today, but he's very adamant that if it doesn't get through this legislative session, he's coming back next year for more. And what he told me in our last interview is that he's going to kind of go on a statewide tour to kind of convince Georgians just how this could be a benefit all the way around, a win-win situation for Georgia. So he's not defeated. He's not at all defeated. If it gets attached and it revives itself, good, but he'll be back next year with more.
Okay, one thing that we have not heard a lot about, and I was kind of surprised, was the education bill. What happened with that?
It skirted through very quietly and giving, you know, the governor a little bit of what he was after last year. At least it starts the process of fixing some of our state's underperforming, I hate to say failing, but underperforming schools.
I want to make sure everyone stays with us here. There was a referendum that would have enacted a plan by the governor to allow the state to basically take control. I think that's fair.
Called it opportunity schools.
Right, opportunity school districts. That did not pass. So how is that different from what had just passed through the Georgia legislature?
This assigns kind of a school resource officer to start the process with just five schools, just five low-performing schools, monitoring them, trying to get them back on track, monitoring the school boards. While it's not a huge step because there are hundreds of underperforming schools here in our state, it's just the beginning. So Governor Deal seems to be pleased with this option.
Okay, so we've talked about the campus rape bill, not as dead as formerly believed, the campus carry bill, not dead.
Isn't that how it goes, though?
It's true.
You wonder why the enthusiasm behind Signe Die, because these legislators are really having to work, especially on day 40.
As Robbie says, all bets off.
Right.
So what else has possibly survived and might survive through?
Oh, boy. Let's see. Trey Kelly's bill, House Bill 118 to regulate fantasy sports websites and how the payouts
treat it like gambling.
Treat it like gambling, and there are concerns about how the payouts were promised but yet not given. So he wanted a little more regulation there. Trey Kelly's driverless car bill, it did not cross over, but there's some signs that there's a Senate version of that bill, so we may see or hear more of that today. That passed the Senate by a wide margin. Let's see what might else be out there. I'm telling you, that campus carry bill is going to get a lot of talk and action today for sure.
It's going to be pretty emotional, and that is one where every single campus police department has come out against it.
And there's so many polls against it. So you're wondering where the steam is coming from.
Well, that would be my question. That was my next question for you is, is the support for this in the legislature when voters are very much against it? The university deans are against it and university police are against it.
And it's very bipartisan. You find all the majority of Democrats are against it and the majority of Republicans are. So I think, with them having the majority, that's where it's coming from. But again, is it going to get past the governor? A lot of people doubt it will. So we'll have to wait and see.
You seem to be doubting it will as you shake your head.
I mean, the logic. I think Governor Deal is listening to a lot of concerned parents right now. I have a son going to college, and I'm very concerned.
Yeah.
You just don't want anybody walking around with a gun, even if they, have the permit, and even if they are 21 and deemed adult. You just don't want that.
Yeah, I've seen young college students get very upset when they got a D, for example.
It's frightening.
Yeah.
It's frightening. We've all been there. We've heard the stories when, on our, prospective college campuses. So, I don't know. There's still a lot of doubt in the air about campus carry.
We have about 30 seconds left. Lisa, is this going to be a long night?
I think it's going to be a long night. Good Lord. Let's see. The House, 60 bills and resolutions on calendar today. The Senate, 21 bills and resolutions. So it probably will skirt close to midnight, if not beyond. So I don't know. A lot of people might be sleeping when they're throwing up the papers and screaming, Signe Die, and running all over the place. I don't know. But I'll be there. We'll be there and keep you posted
on
everything.
She's drinking coffee.
Yes.
And if you would, you're more than welcome to call and correct my pronunciation, as I'm not a native Atlantan. Sam Burnham tweets, extra syllables in Georgia? Never.
Never.
If it's supposed to be Signe Die, then just let me know. Lisa Raham covers the state capitol for GPB's lawmakers. Thank you so much.
Thank you. What a pleasure. Thank you.
Just ahead, Latino congregations growing fast in Georgia. First, though, the state's marijuana bill could have huge consequences for AIDS patients. This is on Second Thought. This is on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. One bill that's poised to make it through both chambers of the legislature would expand access to medical marijuana. Patients diagnosed with AIDS, for example, would be able to get a prescription. Dr. Rashawn Hodge is a medical director for Premier Chronic Pain Care in Atlanta. It's good to have you here.
Good morning.
Good morning. And continuing with us is GPB Capital correspondent Lisa Raham.
Good
Hello
morning.
Again. So, Lisa, this we already had one medical marijuana bill pass. What does this one do?
It expands on HB1 and includes six additional illnesses that can be treated. They are autism, Tourette syndrome, AIDS, Alzheimer's, peripheral neuropathy, and epidermolysis bullosa. They are the new conditions, and anyone in hospice is also eligible. Now, the big stickler was it does not include HIV this time around, but it does include AIDS, yes.
And that brings us to you, Sean, because why is there a medical or a clinical reason for including AIDS patients in this but leaving out HIV patients?
Well, AIDS, to add AIDS was definitely a victory.
Yeah.
And we definitely need to, include HIV because it doesn't make sense to withhold medication or treatment, which
you can't think of a clinical reason to do that.
Not at all.
How effective is medical marijuana at helping a person with AIDS overcome that pain?
Well, most AIDS patients commonly have peripheral neuropathy.
Which is
pain that usually starts at the feet or at the hands. It's usually bilateral, both hands and feet. And it starts with just a numbness, pricking pain, and then it eventually it's a constant pain. And this pain is really debilitating. Because it's this natural instinct. If something really hurts to move, you just move less, you hang out less. You know, your activity of daily livings actually decrease because you're just so fearful of another pain.
Which is
going
to also, just your inactivity is going to impact your health.
Absolutely.
So is marijuana, has that been shown to be effective at treating that pain?
Absolutely. Over 20 years, there's been an FDA-approved drug called Marinol, and that's specifically for AIDS. It targets AIDS wasting, anorexia. Also, it targets the pain as well. So that's an FDA-approved drug, over 20 years old, and it's synthetic cannabis.
Lisa, do we have any idea, do we have yet a glimpse into the minds of the lawmakers as to why they'd include AIDS but not HIV?
There was a lot of back and forth going between the Senate and House on what diseases should be covered by that, and it resulted in a major compromise, and that compromise resulting in these six specific diseases. And I think a lot hinged on severity, is that correct, of how serious a lot of these diseases are in the various stages.
Correct. Yeah, we were successfully able to remove the end stage off the original Haley's Hope Act 2 years ago, 2015. It was end-stage Parkinson's, end-stage ALS, end-stage AIDS, end-stage
right,
cancer.
Right, end-stage multiple sclerosis, yeah.
And it didn't make sense clinically to withhold medication that which can prevent the progression of the disease and potentially cure the patient, you know, with cannabis. So we removed the end stage off, and that was, again, another victory.
And a major compromise, they added the language that anyone in hospice could also be eligible. So that covers a wide array of illnesses in
Absolutely.
Itself.
Absolutely.
There's still one big problem, though, and let's let Alan Peake speak for himself. He's the state representative. He's the sponsor of the medical marijuana bill.
I'm grateful that we've moved the ball. We're not there yet. We still have a huge issue of where do we access the product. And until we deal with that, we're still going to be shortchanging our citizens in some respects.
Lisa, what does he mean there? Where do we access the product?
So, yeah, you extend it to all these people, but are they breaking the law when they get the
right,
the
you're
oil
not allowed
and
to
they
grow
use
it
it
here.
Yeah, cultivation and obtaining it. And he says that's going to be the next round of debate. Hopefully this next legislative session, he's going to champion that because
you can't cultivate it here, and it's illegal to bring it across state lines.
So still, do you have to go to Colorado to use it, you know, to get
right,
it?
To move to another state.
Yeah, so that's a real sticking point. While this is a huge victory,
absolutely.
Now, you know, how do we get it in state? How do we make it legal? How do you, you know, cultivate it and have easy access to it?
So, Rashawn, what is it that doctors need? As a prescribing doctor, what do you need the legislature to do now?
We need access for our patients, you know, and doctors need to be part of that process, I believe, you know, in my opinion, you know, to make this seamless for our patients. If we're recommending medicinal cannabis cards for our patients, we have the continuity of care, we should be able to have access to medication to prescribe to our patients.
Is it fair to say that we're talking about tens of thousands of people in Georgia that would be affected by this?
We have over 10 million Georgians. It's millions of Georgians.
Who have either HIV or AIDS.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, Atlanta is ranks fifth in HIV cases in the country. So it's equivalent to a third world country. So we have In terms of numbers, absolutely. And that's going to cost our healthcare system millions and millions of dollars. which, you know, would be cut if we added, you know, if they had more access to medicinal cannabis, because it's going to help them save money with their nausea. You know, cannabis helps with nausea, it helps with their pain, it helps with mood. So less antidepressants are being picked up, less antiemetics are going to get picked up. They're going to need less narcotics, which will help reduce the opioid problem as well.
Very emotional issue. I think Representative Peek had support on both sides of the aisle with this. And on Tuesday, he received a standing ovation for his efforts in getting this done. But very, very emotional issue. And I think both sides recognize that something has to be done in terms of access.
Right. That was my next question. Yeah. It seems clear that Representative Peek will sponsor the bill, but will it get the support, do you think?
Yeah, Senator Ben Watson has championed it in the Senate, and everybody seems to be on board at this point. It took some convincing. I mean, you know, he had the people raising eyebrows early on, and he's been at this for several years now. But I think he's brought all people on board, because you have parents bringing their children and saying they can now speak, they can now, you know, utter a few words, you know. I think when they see that, you know, it really tugs at the heart.
That is Lisa Rayum. She covers the Capitol for GPB's lawmakers, and we spoke with Dr. Rashawn Hodge. He's the medical director of Premier Chronic Pain Care in Atlanta. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Atlanta has the fastest growing Episcopal diocese in the world. It's the eighth largest of the 109 dioceses around the globe. And Latino congregations are really driving that surge in church attendance, which is the opposite of what's happening in almost all churches. Reverend Robert Wright is a bishop of the Episcopal diocese in Atlanta. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So you're nodding your head, but if you look at statistics, church attendance is really declining. It's either some churches are seeing static numbers, or all across the board they're going down. So let's start with, what do you think is driving that?
Yeah, I think as a general matter, it's a generational phenomena. I think a lot of people generationally are choosing to exercise spirituality in other ways rather than in a sanctuary with people on Sunday morning.
So then that brings us to why we are seeing such large increases in Hispanic populations, especially in Georgia, as opposed to states that maybe have a larger population of Hispanics, like Texas or California or Arizona.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have 14 congregations, worshiping communities that are Hispanic all around Middle and North Georgia. And when I go there and I'm with folks, it's a generational thing also. These are first generation, by and large, people who are coming to this country as sort of that pioneering generation. And they're bringing their sort of commitment to traditional faith expressions forward. It's a pivot point for them as they come and they aspire and climb up the ladder educationally and otherwise. They're resting on their faith and they're finding a home in the Episcopal Church.
So let's hear writer David Kinnaman talking about the lack of attendance in church and why it's dropping.
Certainly a lot of young people are very distracted. Church attendance is much less appealing now in a technological world where they can have community such as it is online. But for us as Christians, we're not giving them a reason to follow Christ. We're not listening to their concerns. We're not interested in who they're becoming in Christ.
And so how do you, with some of these first generation people who are still have that tradition of going to church, which may not be true for other Americans, how do you then address what he's talking about and keep those congregations healthy?
Yeah, I think it's incumbent on the people who are in my business, the people who are facilitating worship, to connect with the people. I mean, that's the work. That's the sort of, our pioneer is Jesus. And one of the ways we watch him walk and talk in the world is he's connecting with real people in real crisis and turmoil and trouble. And so I think it's an invitation for the church to get back to basics.
So we're talking with Bishop Robert Wright of the Episcopal Diocese of Atlanta. Atlanta has the fastest growing Episcopal diocese in the world at this point, driven by often Hispanic congregations. So in some ways, these dioceses have stepped in some social services, and I wanted to ask you about that. The First Unitarian Society Church in Colorado actually offers sanctuary to undocumented members. Here's Minister Beth Chronister. She was asked if ICE, the immigration forces, might seek out these members at the church.
They don't. It would just look so bad that they probably wouldn't. I think that there's the same sort of respect for schools and hospitals that they have for churches.
Do you find that the diocese has ends up stepping in or providing social services for new immigrants and maybe undocumented immigrants?
Yeah, we call it pastoral care. I think when we find people who don't have resources, don't have information that that can be helpful to them in their life circumstances, I think it's the role of the church to provide care in that fashion. And so, yeah, we want to help them understand what their rights are. We want to help them understand that there are resources if a family member is deported. We want to sort of point them to lawyers who can help them navigate the system such that they need to navigate it. So, yeah, we call that pastoral care. Sanctuary is a word, but it ends up having more emotional content than practical content. We think pastoral care is the word. How are we demonstrating our concern for people in real life turmoil?
Do you ever have concerns over clashes between the church and federal forces, especially under the new administration, which is being aggressive with immigration enforcement?
Yeah, I think people are concerned about that. But I think what drives our work is not just to use words like undocumented or immigrant or illegal. I think what we've got to remember as we begin to do anything is that we're talking about people. We're talking about men and women and children. We're talking about families being split apart. And so I think that we can not be sideways to law enforcement. We can honor the laws. And at the same time, the church's role is to respect the dignity of every human being. And that's our work. And to find that out and to do that every day is our calling.
So Georgia doesn't have the largest number of Latino and Hispanic immigrants.
That's right.
And yet we have the fastest growing congregation, largely driven by Hispanics and Latinos.
Yeah.
Do you have any clue as to why that is?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. It's a mystery. You know, what we're learning is that it's word of mouth. I mean, people are finding a home with us. A lot of Hispanics traditionally come from the Catholic Church. And yet they're finding their home with the Episcopal Church because many of them cannot live up to the doctrine as sort of taught by the Catholic Church, the traditional model of families that are many people have divorces or children out of wedlock. And that is not our part. Our part is to welcome everybody where they are. And so it's a sacramental church. It's a liturgical church. We have vestments. We have communion. You know, we honor the scriptures in that way. And so they come in and they see those things familiar and join up with us.
So do you look at these really vibrant and large congregations and then try to get some clues as to how that might help other congregations which are dwindling?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the sort of geniuses of our tradition is finding out how to get the words of God into people's idiom and context. And so I think how do you indigenize worship? And I think that
what does that mean? Indigenize worship?
Yeah, it means to honor the people's idiom. It means to use their words, to use their musical expression, to point to that as sacred and holy, and to fold that into the ritual of worship, rather than to sort of give them sort of some kind of colonized version of something. It is to say that God is in your idiom, God is in your language, God is in your food and your traditions, and to celebrate that and honor that.
Do you have to, do you think the church is going to have to change in order to, in general, accommodate, as we just heard a moment, young people who are easily distracted or by the cell phones in their hands?
Yeah, I pray to God that the church is always changing. I mean, we can't say that God is alive and the Spirit is moving and that the church must remain stagnant. I mean, that's sort of counter-cognitive. What we have to be doing is evolving with the Spirit. And as I understand Spirit is always reaching out to people. And so what the church needs to be doing always is staying in step with God. I find that God is radically moving in the world. And the church is sort of behind on her heels. And so in opportunities like we're talking about today among Hispanic people and other people, young people, I think we're being invited because of their absence in church to go out and find them and to bring the good news that we think we know to them and to point to the good news that's already in their midst.
But does that mean between that and indigenizing worship,
yeah,
does that mean that some of these services are held in Spanish?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, my learning curve has been how to celebrate the Mass in Spanish. And
How are you doing on that?
Well, I'm doing the best I can, I have to tell you. But I tell you, it makes me respect the people who come to this country from other places who learn our language. My God, I wish I was as good and as courageous a Spanish speaker as the Hispanic people that I meet who are attempting English so as they can make their way. So yeah, they've been very kind to me as I've been practicing the Mass in Spanish. Very encouraging to me.
So in the minute that we have left, what is the church's role? I mean, because the conflict sometimes between church congregations and what's happening in politics and among state and federal government is quite clear. So what's the church's role there?
The church's role is very clear. I mean, we believe in the respecting the dignity of every human being. So we come down on the side of respecting the dignity and worth of all human beings. And that is absolutely sacrosanct. So I think we've got to go and find out places where we think that the dignity of people is not being upheld. And so when we talk about illegal, undocumented, these sorts of things, these are categories that don't necessarily honor the dignity of people, right? It puts them through this sort of sausage grinder of a process without acknowledging the fact that these are human beings. Number two, I think we're at our best when we live out of that. And so that's our biblical tradition. All through Scripture, we've had, we're called to make that real. Our president wants to make the country great. And in fact, the historic understanding of a great nation in the Bible is someone who cares for her poor and marginalized, the alien and stranger. And so we've got to leverage that concern in real ways to advocate for those who don't have a voice and to be helpmates of people who need help.
That is Bishop Robert Wright of the Episcopal Diocese of Atlanta. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, the Breakroom Gang considers if monogamy is natural for human beings. New research shows we may have been misled on this issue for decades. And we'd love to hear from you. Is a monogamous relationship the ideal? Is it the most natural and healthy way to live? Call us at 404-500-9457, or you can post on Facebook and then tune in tomorrow for that discussion. Author Greg Iles has sold millions of books, tens of millions. He's written 15 novels. 12 of them have been New York Times bestsellers. And his latest novel is Mississippi Blood. It's the final installment of a trilogy that he began 8 years ago. Greg, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Celeste. Glad to be here.
The trilogy itself features your character, Penn Cage, who was a one-time prosecutor, then a novelist, and now seems to have been for some time combining those two together. But those aren't the only novels that feature Penn Cage. How did you decide to sort of set apart these novels for a trilogy?
Well, you know, I never really intended for Penn to be a series character. But as I kept returning to themes of the South and family and race in particular, Penn proved to be a good vehicle to explore that, and particularly Penn's father, who's based on my father, a beloved family physician whose practice was about 65% black patients, and he had a lot of insight into the racial situation in the South.
So why, if you didn't intend for him to be a series character, how did that happen? How did you get to your second book and say, I need to bring Penn back?
Well, I wrote the first one in 1998. And then 7 years later, I returned to a story in my hometown, Natchez, Mississippi, and Penn was the natural character to go to see the story through his eyes. And as he evolved and his family evolved as characters, I found myself returning to Natchez every 7 years or so, and as Faulkner said, exploring my own little postage stamp of America. So Penn was the natural vehicle. And so sort of against my will, I turned him into this character for the trilogy.
So I wonder if an unintended consequence is the fact that there's been more tourism in Natchez. Maybe people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. One critic said I do Natchez the backhanded compliment of setting my novels there. I mean, I'm portraying some of the most troublesome history in 20th century America. But yeah, tourism has certainly spiked as a result of the novels.
And I think your office, you call it Edelweiss, is located not too far from a fort where several massacres took place.
Absolutely. You know, it was built in 1883, and it was called Edelweiss then, and I restored it, and it's even featured in the book. So real life, in my books, real life intersects a lot. I mean, the civil rights murders that occur throughout the trilogy are based on real life murders that happened about 12 miles from my house in the 60s.
Okay, so we learn throughout your books, and they're heavily featured in these trilogy books, is sort of the two different examples of African-American men. One is Quentin Avery, who used to be a civil rights attorney and then became a personal injury attorney. And then there's the guy who returns from Chicago to run for mayor and then becomes a district attorney. I hope I'm not giving too much away from all your books.
No, that's good. That's a good subject, yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about the creation of these two characters and sort of who your inspirations are for them.
Well, I've lived in Natchez most of my life, except for leaving to go to college, et cetera. And, you know, Natchez is over 50% African-American. And like my dad, I grew up working with black guys, if I can speak colloquially, you know, and I've met a lot of different types of personalities. And here's an example of the complexity of race in a place like Natchez. Last year, I worked running communications for black mayoral candidate who won the election with 90% of the vote in a 50% black district. Now, ironically, what we've learned is that our biggest obstacle to progress is not the white community. It's older style elements of the black community who remain obstacles to his progressive agenda. So, as you know, race is a very complex issue, not simplistic the way it's portrayed.
Do you ever have concerns? Do you get other people to read them over? We've heard talk of authors who have sort of sensitivity readers read through.
I don't do my readers and my sensitivity readers. You know, last night in the hotel, I was celebrating because the book just went number one nationwide. I got back to the hotel and there was a letter from an African-American woman who had just finished the book, and she was a little upset. There's a strong black female character in the book, very strong.
Yeah.
But the way the book ended with her, the woman was a little upset and disappointed. But I honestly addressed my issues and the way I'd ended it, the way I had, and it satisfied her, and she said she was putting a 5-star review on Amazon. So, you know, I just go with real-time feedback. If you're an artist or you take yourself seriously, you can't go through life asking the opinions of people. You have to put your vision down.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with author Greg Iles. His new novel is called Mississippi Blood. It came out last week, as you just heard. It went number one. This is the first one of your books, I think, that was number one on the USA Today list.
Yeah, I've been number one in the New York Times, but USA Today means you outsold every book of any kind in the whole country. So that's the first time I've ever done that.
All right. So you were in a fatal wreck in 2011. What I've been interested to read is some of your responses to how that changed your writing. I mean, thankfully, you're much recovered now in the ensuing 6 years, right?
Right, right. But it really comes down to this. I mean, I pulled onto Highway 61 when I was trying to write Natchez Burning as a single novel, the first book. A truck hit my door going 70, took off my leg, tore my aorta, smashed many of my bones, and put me in a coma. When I came out, I realized that because I was writing about race, the South, family, I was not going to pull any punches, that I didn't have forever to live. And that meant being more honest than I'd ever been and maybe than a lot of people would have liked me to be.
And one of the ways that is manifest in your books, which is always interesting to me, is the way that people talk about race in ways that you don't expect. In other words, in one of your early books, not part of this trilogy, you have the very Northern Yankee early girlfriend of Penn Cage.
You do know these books.
Yeah. I do. I love these books. So she comes down south, and she comes down as a looking down on the South, thinking that it's the most racist place she's ever going to live, and she changes her mind completely. Are all of these things based on people that you've met and perspectives that you've heard?
Sure. I mean, I'm going to tell you what most writers want. All writers are writing about themselves, and any that tell you they're not are lying, or either lying and they don't know they're lying. Okay?
They're in denial.
One thing I hope these books have done, though, is I'm trying to break that American stereotype about the South that, oh, isn't that racism terrible down there in Mississippi, down there in Georgia? We all know racism has been bad in the South, but it's always been overt, open, out in the street. In the North, it's covert, but it's there. And if the events of the last year or two have taught us anything, it's that racism is not a sectional Southern problem. It's an American problem. And that's what I want to help address.
Now, this may be the end of the trilogy, which began with Natchez Burning, then we got Bone Tree, and now Mississippi Blood. But is this the end of Penn Cage?
Well, if you get to the end of Mississippi Blood, you'll realize there probably is room for one more.
No spoilers.
It's certainly the end of the trilogy. No spoilers. But I think there'll be one more Penn book. It will not be next. But to be fair to that universe, I probably need to go back one time.
So what do you have left? What do you have left to say about Natchez? Are you done talking about your hometown?
No. Well, you know what? Natchez is emblematic of a lot of Mississippi and probably some places in Georgia. It was once one of the richest cities in the entire country, despite being so small. It's now been shrinking steadily for about 30 years. We're trying to save it, both black and white. Communities like Greenville, where Morgan Freeman has investments, communities like that have been going steadily down. We don't want to meet that fate. And I hope that my work and my books can help preserve it, because a guy said something. I'll say this about the South. A guy once said, it would be a shame that if in our rush to extinguish the South's ancient sins, we also bury its enduring virtues as well. So I want to save and preserve what's good and hopefully rectify what's bad.
So if I can just indulge my own curiosity in the last minute we have, why do you call your book tour the Nerd Tour?
Well, half of it's on land and in a vehicle, and half of it's on an airplane. And I traded in, you know, when I wrecked, I was in a very expensive all-aluminum Audi. This time we're in a brand-new Ford Flex, which very much looks like a nerdy box, so I'm calling it the Nerd Tour. You know, I play in a band with Stephen King and a bunch of writers, and we always name our tours like the Still Younger Than Keith Tour or things like that. So this is the Nerd Tour.
Greg Iles, his new novel is Mississippi Blood. It hit shelves last week, and Greg will give a Q&A session tomorrow night at the Carter Library in Atlanta. Thank you.
Thanks, Celeste.
Let's move on from Southern literature to Southern music. If you're a fan of NPR's Tiny Desk Concerts, you've probably heard Tank and the Bangas. The New Orleans group won this year's NPR Tiny Desk Contest. The band comes to Atlanta tonight with a performance tied to the Atlanta Film Festival. GPB's Sean Powers caught up with the lead singer.
My name is Tariana Tank Ball, and I am the lead singer of Tank and the Bangas. And we are from New Orleans, Louisiana.
The moment you tie your own shoes, or spell your name in your alphabet soup, or told your mom that you're walking to the bus stop by yourself. Don't talk to strangers.
I started mixing in music with my poetry because I guess I was born in New Orleans, and being around people like Asia Rainey and Sonny Patterson and Catalyst and Icon the artist, we always mixed our music with our poetry because it was where we were from. There is a piece that I go back to my experiences, my experience with Katrina.
The story is breaking at this hour. Hurricane Katrina, the monster storm bearing down on New Orleans, coastal Mississippi, and coastal Alabama. Katrina downgraded.
I think about my grandma's house a lot and how safe and awesome it felt. And I go through the emotions of literally crawling through a window just to get inside her home. And I've never had to do that before. And going in her home and seeing it absolutely ripped apart and thinking about the fact that my grandma wanted to stay in New Orleans and we convinced her to leave with us, and how she would have died if she would have stayed. Well, it's a poem, and it starts off, it was a direct hit. The splash went smash. The house crumbled beneath the weight. There's water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink. I miss my grandmother's house. She had the type of neighborhood that would have grandchildren swarming like bees, hoping to lick the nectar of 25-cent frozen cups from Miss Ella down the street. Wasn't no such thing as the flavor of strawberry. You see, we lived in color. Like, can I have a red, please? I remember getting up early to Christian Union Baptist Church, where my grandfather, Reverend Bradford, was the pastor. Cranberry juice and communion crackers, Chris the ushers, and my grandmama at the door. But grandmama is not here no more, and no longer is her home. And at least when grandparents were leaving, we would still have their homes. The scent of their recipes still cooking on them stoves. And some people still ask us why we sing those Wade in the Water songs, or why we write those Katrina poems, because I still miss my grandmother's house. I think that the storm touched with my music or influenced my music in a way of how important it is to feel home even when you're not there. to remember things that are special to you that only New Orleans people can know about.
If anybody ever forgot to tell you, you are important. You are special even. Your body was made especially extravagant, extra human.
The backstory behind human was just feeling really impossible one day. And I remember listening to a poet say, if you break down the word impossible, I'm possible. I think it's so true. When people say stuff like, I'm just human, I mean, what do you expect from me? I'm just human. I think that's a cop-out. Like, this is an incredible thing to be. This is an incredible person to be. This is a living thing. And when you watch the Olympics and when you see singers and actors remember a million lines, to be human is to be an incredible life force. Don't weaken it.
You should play with him. I'm sure your attention won't cause a deficient amount in nerve cells. Us women, we blink nearly twice as much as men, so keep looking. She'll notice you. May take her a little longer, but she's got to. The average human heart will beat over 1 million times in one lifetime. I am sure you'll find someone who won't mind skipping one for you.
Left lung. I see Tank and Vanga's. In New Orleans, I haven't seen a woman head a group of guys like this in a long time. And New Orleans needs that. New Orleans needs the next amazing group of creativity coming out and sharing it with the world so they could know what goes on down here. It's important. It's special, and it always has been. And I'm excited for people to see that. It's dope to be a gutsy chick. It really is. To say some of the things I say or you say and do it, it's dope. And it feels free. And that is the only way to live this life.
It's so beautiful, special. Yes, you are.
That's Tarianna Tank Ball. She's the lead singer of the New Orleans band Tank and the Bangas. The group performs tonight as part of the Atlanta Film Festival. You can get more details at gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today, but we always welcome your comment. But we always welcome your comments, especially if you have music recommendations or if you think your band should be in a Tiny Desk concert. We want to hear from you. You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.